Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the long run, we're all dead, said economist John Maynard Keynes, lover of the pithy aphorism and the well-placed government stimulus. In the short run, right now, everyone is freaked about the economy and praying that a giant stimulus will shock it back to life. Keynes and Keynesian economics are back in a huge way. Lord Robert Skidelsky, economist and great Keynes biographer, is with me today. This hour, On Point, Economic Crisis and the Return of John Maynard Keynes. You can join the conversation. Are we all Keynesians now, ready with Barack Obama to pour on the economic stimulus, the government spending? Do we have a choice? Joining me now from London is Robert Skidelsky, Lord Robert Skidelsky, peer of the realm in the UK and great biographer of John Maynard Keynes. He's Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at Warwick University, Director and Advisor to Mutual Funds and Hedge Funds and Enterprise from New York to Europe to Moscow, Janus Capital, the Greater Europe Fund, Russian telecom giant Sistema. His columns and essays appear in papers around the world. He's active in the British House of Lords. And over three decades, he rolled out the three volumes of his famed Keynes biography, now rolled into one, John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, economist, philosopher, statesman. Robert Skidelsky, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
It's very nice to have you. Is there any doubt?
Good to be with you.
Wonderful to have you as well. Is there any question what Keynes would be telling Barack Obama if he could sit with him for an hour right now about what ought to be done with the U.S. economy, just for starters?
In general, no, there wouldn't be much doubt. I'm also pleased to say that in the long run, Keynes isn't dead. He's the exception to his own rule. I don't think there'd be much doubt about what he'd be saying. He'd be talking about stimulus. Then it's a question of what kind of stimulus, how much stimulus, how much to do on the monetary side, how much to do on the fiscal side, all those sorts of questions. I think people are being very Keynesian. They don't even have to listen to him particularly. They already know what they should be doing.
You're just back in London from the United States, from New York. You know the kind of expectation here, somewhere from a $600 million to a $1 trillion stimulus may be on Barack Obama's desk on the very first day, on the day he's sworn into office for a signature. Perhaps it's being pushed. From what you see so far in terms of scale and focus, the way the U.S. package appears to be coming together, in its early architecture, does it seem like the right stuff?
I think it is basically right. The U.S. economy is projected to shrink by 4 or 5% in the last quarter of this year, and probably a similar figure over that sort of kind of figure next year. And in face of that, you need a really large stimulus. And I think that the figures being talked about, which are in trillions of dollars, are right. I don't think you can do it for less, and there's more to come. What I think will be very, very interesting is whether Obama will really go for a new deal in his inauguration, because I think that's what people are waiting for now, and then his plans will be unveiled.
You know, one of the great things about talking with you is you're looking as an economist at the situation right now. You also know the history very well. What about the original New Deal? How did Keynes and FDR interact on that great response to the Depression?
Well, I think Keynes greatly admired FDR spirit. And there's no doubt that the inaugural, the only thing you've got to fear is fear itself, and that message was a tremendous inspiration to people, especially people who were expecting a much bolder government approach to the slump than the Hoover administration had revealed. But Keynes did write something very interesting to Roosevelt in 1933. They met a couple of times, and I think they liked each other a lot. But Keynes wrote to him an interesting thing, and he said, you know, you're engaged in a double enterprise, both recovery and reform, but do put recovery first. Don't try and reform too much at the beginning, because that might damage the very confidence of businessmen that you're trying to restore. Get the recovery going and get the reform going on the back of the recovery. That was his message, and he characteristically said, otherwise, you're going to give yourself an administration too much to think about all at once. And I think that's quite good advice for today. Everyone's talking about the reform of the banking system, what kind of regulation we need in the future, and all that is very important. But the first things first, get the economy moving again.
Does that mean it doesn't matter how the money is spent, just spend the money in economic terms? Or is the exact targeting of this maybe $1 trillion, maybe more, critical in the Keynesian big view?
Well, you know, there's a famous remark in The General Theory. He said, if the Treasury were to fill old bottles with banknotes and bury them and leave it to private enterprise to dig the notes up again, right, there need be no more unemployment. And of course, Keynes said, look, if you can't think of anything better to spend the money on, then well, do it that way. If you're too wedded to sound finance to have any better thoughts, that will help, because after all, there'll be some production even on that basis, which is better than having millions of people doing nothing at all. But of course, he was very well aware that some projects are much better than others, and he would have actually accelerated infrastructure projects. He would have said the Depression is the time to do all the things that one kept putting off because perhaps they weren't quite as productive as things that were being done, but under conditions of slump, they would be productive enough to warrant spending money on them.
I wish you'd look back for us on two great periods. First, the kind of mid-20th century, when Keynesian economics ruled, and what the broad shape of that period was in applying those economics. And then the large period where Keynes fell out of favor. What was the nature of the time when he was kind of large and in charge, his thinking, and why did it fall out of favor?
Well, you know, historians have been arguing about whether it was Keynesian economics that kept prosperity at such a high level, and it was. These were called the golden years.
The 50s, 60s.
50s, 60s, until early 70s. They were golden years, but were they the Keynesian years? The jury's out on that. Mm-hmm. On the whole, governments balance their budgets. They occasionally unbalance them. But they weren't profligate. They weren't running continuous budget deficits. So what was it really that kept demand at such a high level? Well, I think there were two things. First of all, people knew that they had the government behind them, that the government was not going to allow any real slump to develop. Secondly, I think the markets were pretty well regulated. There was very little international capital mobility that was controlled. The banking sector was quite highly regulated. So there wasn't a lot of the potential volatility was taken out of the system by these two factors. I should add a third fact. America was spending a terrific amount of money abroad, and it was really American dollars pouring into the world economy that, if you like, was global Keynesianism. So I think those were the factors that were important at the time.
And then Keynes and his economics fell out of favor very sharply. Why?
Well, Milton Friedman and others said it was because they led to inflation. And indeed, there was. The inflation started rising at the end of the 1960s. And that then attempts to get inflation down led to higher unemployment. And you got into a period, a ratcheting effect, in which you had unemployment and inflation increasing simultaneously. Now, was that due to Keynesian economics, or was that due to other bits of policy? Was it due, for example, the inflation, that is, due to the huge American spending on the Vietnam War, which took off at that time? Remember, wars have always been inflationary periods. No one needed Keynesian economics to organize an inflation. You just had to have a medium-sized war. Mm. And it's a bit unfair, I think, to blame Keynesian economics for the inflation that then ended the reputation of Keynes.
Now we're about to have, between Iraq, Afghanistan, and stimulus, Keynesian economics and war. Is inflation inevitable on the other side of this, wherever that may be?
Well, if we simply spend money with total abandon, then of course inflation will eventually pick up. But at the moment, the forces are on the other side. They're deflationary. The prices have inflation has started to go down dramatically all over the world, and commodity prices have fallen enormously. So those two factors that were really stoking up inflation have really gone the other way, and I think the danger is deflation. And without deflation, you wouldn't be facing the prospect of a serious recession. So I don't think the danger is inflation. If you go on spending in the way that would be justifiable for a short period of time, after the economy has started to recover, then of course you do risk a serious inflation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economic crisis and the urge to stimulate, a la economist John Maynard Keynes, the urgent rebirth right now of Keynesian economics. Stimulus, government spending, government to the rescue, and the man who drew the blueprint, Keynes. Lord Robert Skidelsky joins us from London, the great biographer of Keynes. His three volumes rolled into one, John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, economist, philosopher, statesman. He's right in the thick of this. Robert Skidelsky, we have a lot of listeners who want to speak with you already, and I'm sure the economics are going to swallow us up here. But before we do that, I wish you'd just give us a sense, the thumbnail sketch, a sense of the man, so we don't lose him in the midst of the economics. Keynes was no stranger to crisis, whether Depression or World War II. He was in the thick of these things.
Yes, and World War I as well, when he was in the British Treasury. He was a Renaissance man. His wife said he was more than an economist. And I think that's the key to everything. He didn't just look at the world from the standpoint of an economist, but from the standpoint of a philosopher, a historian, someone very, very closely involved in practical affairs. And that gave him a very acute sense of human behavior.
Also, aesthete, art patron, and stock speculator. I mean, the whole sort of gamut here, from the Bloomsbury Circle to the exchange, the city.
Absolutely. Patron of the arts, member of the Bloomsbury Group, and as you rightly say, a very successful investor himself. He was chairman of a couple of investment trusts, a mutual life assurance company, and he made a lot of money himself. He managed the affairs of his own college, King's College, Cambridge, very successfully, especially when he didn't have a committee to tell him what to do.
Critical to the British war effort and its financing and the UK relationship with the US in those years.
Yes, he was essentially Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer in reality, though he was only an advisor to the Treasury. His reputation was so huge on both sides of the Atlantic that he was almost a British ambassador, extra ambassador, and he negotiated with Assistant Secretary of State Harry Dexter White and Morgenthau on equal terms. Mm-hmm. What wasn't equal was the position of the two countries. Britain actually was he had to hand out the begging bowl in order to keep Britain in the war, and that doesn't make for a strong bargaining position. But what brains and intelligence and goodwill and good argument could do, he did on behalf of the Allies.
And, of course, there's Bretton Woods. He was key in pulling that together and in helping guide it. Died just 4 months after the Bretton Woods agreements came into effect. People talking again today about needing another Bretton Woods, about a new kind of lacing up of international financial regulation.
Yes, when you roll out the achievements, one wonders whether there's been any economist who's ever achieved so much in the worlds of both theory and policy. And Bretton Woods was the supreme achievement of his life in a practical sense. He didn't get everything he wanted by any means, and he thought the system was quite defective as it had been set up. But he got a good compromise from his point of view. He got America involved in the management of the world economy, which was his greatest aim. And, you know, when people talk about a new Bretton Woods, they've often forgotten what the old Bretton Woods was actually about. They talk about it in terms of having an international regulatory system for the banks and a lot of technical things. But the original Bretton Woods really set up the system of exchange rates guaranteed to stabilize exchange rates and give the world a stable platform from which to grow. And one has to think of a new Bretton Woods in those terms rather than just as a bit of fiddling around with the banking system.
Now, you written recently, of course, everyone was fixated when Alan Greenspan testified before Congress in October and talked about the whole intellectual edifice of his sort of view of the world collapsing not so long ago. Listen with us, if you would, to just a little bit of the tape. This is October 23rd, Alan Greenspan, former Fed chair in the U.S., grilled by Congressman Harry Waxman, California Democrat, and Waxman pressing him here on whether he could have done more to regulate markets and prevent the subprime mess.
Do you feel that your ideology pushed you to make decisions that you wish you had not made?
Well, remember that what an ideology is, it's a conceptual framework with the way people deal with reality. Everyone has one. You have to exist, you need an ideology. The question is whether it is accurate or not. And what I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact.
The one-time maestro, Alan Greenspan, after he had said that the whole intellectual edifice had collapsed. Robert Skidelsky, how would you define, Greenspan, we don't have him here to do it for himself, but how would you broadly define the intellectual edifice that he's talking about collapsing there? What has come down and left Keynes standing again in its place?
You know, I wish someone had pursued him on that. It was just enough to be intensely interested.
Always the
what
cryptic.
Was, yeah, but it was cryptic, and they didn't really go for the real answer to that. So you have to guess in a way what that intellectual mm-hmm. edifice was. You have to deduce it almost from the way he acted and from his support for extensive deregulation. I think the edifice was really that markets were efficient, and you couldn't get this kind of self-destructive orgy, that prices, the trades were basically going to take place at the right prices. And
in other words, he had believed all that, and he was saying, oops.
Yeah, oops. And this wasn't supposed to happen. And I think few things are more poignant than that confession, that there was a flaw. And I think the flaw lies in economics itself. You know, Keynes had a wonderful remark about economics. He called it one of those pretty polite techniques which tries to deal with the present by abstracting from the fact that we know very little about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was this pretense that the whole of the future, you know, could be measured. It was all contained in risk, and that there was no uncertainty really there.
There was kind of like a machine of logic, inexorable, rational, efficient.
Yes, that all the prices in the market were correct prices. They contained all the information that was necessary, including complete information about the structure of the economy. So it couldn't go wrong.
And he did not believe that, and yet we've been operating kind of in the world of Greenspan's and others' presumption along those lines. It doesn't leave a lot of room for Bernard Madoff and a lot of other eventualities.
It doesn't leave a lot of room for Madoff. But, you know, the power of economics can't be underestimated. It is a very, very powerful discipline. And people are entranced by it. Even they study it in universities if they're doing economics. They study it in MBA programs. And policymakers, even if they don't know economics themselves, they're overpowered by the logic of it. I think the logic comes out in the extent to which they allowed financial markets to be deregulated, to the extent in which they allowed commercial banks to become investment banks, and to the extent in which they allowed the hedge fund market to grow exponentially with hardly any regulation. That presupposes a trust in the ability of markets to self-correct very, very quickly. It would update information very, very efficiently, mm-hmm. and prices would move. Of course, they'd move the whole time, but they'd always move it correctly in the correct direction. And I think it excluded the possibility of herd behavior, of everyone all moving in one direction or another, because that would have suggested some serious mispricing somewhere in the system. And I think all that's rubbish, actually. That's not the way human beings behave. And any market, any professional investor knows that's not the way they behave.
This all with very real-world consequences. I want to get to the question of whether we come to some new hybrid on the other side of all these decades and learning, or do we just swing back and forth between Friedman and Keynes, but we have so many listeners waiting to speak with you. Let me turn to a couple, if I may. In Wolfboro, New Hampshire, we have Ed on the line. Ed, you're on the air with Robert Skidelsky.
Oh, what a marvelous program and superb timing. I'm in New Hampshire, which, of course, is where Bretton Woods is located. But my comment would be that, first of all, I think the people of this country voted for what Lord Robert refers to as the New New Deal. I think that phrase is catching on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would see is that in the spirit of Keynes and his group, that we throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at the economy here and see what sticks. The law of unintended consequences will certainly be in play, and there will be critics of what we do, but I think it's what needs to be done. And the comparison between here and between now and the Great Depression is you often hear, oh, this is nothing like the Great Depression. And my father, they were living in Cleveland at the time, and he went to Washington for Roosevelt's inauguration in March of 1933, and he said that the times were desperate economically. And, of course, it's different now, but I would have this question for your guest.
Yes.
Would it be that you could say that the times now are just as serious as they were in the Great Depression, 33 to 38, and that is why we need a new deal, that the times are different, yes, but just as serious.
Ed, let us pick exactly that up, Robert Skidelsky. What about it? And let me add to that, to Ed's question, if we throw the $1 trillion at this problem, however seriously you describe it, will it work? Two questions.
Well, I think that's a very good question. Is it as serious as it was then? The answer is no, but then it wasn't as serious as it was then at the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 1929, 1930, it wasn't as serious as it had become by 1931, 32, mm-hmm. and that's because they didn't throw everything that was necessary at it, and we stand prepared to do so. That's the big difference. Potentially, it is as serious, yes. And will it do the trick? Yes, it'll do the trick. It's very it's a very difficult question, because what's all this designed to do? Throwing $1 trillion or more at things. It's really designed to do two things. One, spending, government spending will compensate, offset the fall in private spending. Mm-hmm. That's point
that's
one.
The idea. Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's the idea to give confidence that the economy will not be allowed to slide down to where it had reached in 1932, and that itself will help people start investing and having more favorable views about the future. It'll brighten their the views they have about the future. So it'll be have a real effect in terms of increased spending and a psychological effect. And I think those two things will pull us out.
This may be a silly question, but does $1 trillion guarantee that effect? Or is it
No.
kind of a gamble?
No, you're going to have to be experimental on this. I don't think it's too much. It may be too little. It depends really on what you think the output gap and the deflationary forces gathering momentum will be. I don't think these things can be. Forecasting isn't an exact science. Mm-hmm. Nothing in economics is an exact science. And, you know, there'll be 10 economists. Some will say it's too much. Some will say it's too little. And the answer is we don't know until it starts biting. Then we'll have a better idea, I think, of where the momentum is.
The $1 trillion question. Wow. Let's go to Laura in Northfield, Vermont. Laura, you're on the air with Lord Robert Skidelsky.
Yes, I have a question for Lord Skidelsky. It's sort of a worry question, and I asked him to do a bit of future gazing. One could not help but be aware of the enormous power of secular forces prior to the financial crisis.
When you say secular forces, you mean sort of long-term externals, oil prices?
Yes, underlying forces such as growth on one-time basis in India and China, mm-hmm. the experience of peak oil, the consolidation of industries to world powers, multinational oligopolistic power. And granted that we face a definitive deflationary period, if I was to worry about anything, it would be the lingering effect of those stimulus programs. And at the same time that we have a resumption of growth and resumption of the ongoing inflationary secular forces, Lord Skidelsky speaks about the inability or the question of the ability of the market to self-correct. I'm more concerned about the inability of fiscal policy to reestablish fiscal restraint, raise taxes, do those sorts of things. So, again,
on the other side, our time is short before the break, so how do we get back to fiscal balance on the other side and the inflation worry, I guess,
exactly.
Laura?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
Robert Skidelsky.
Well, look, if output in the absence of any stimulus is going to fall by 5% and you have a stimulus of 5%, you're not really faced with runaway inflation. A lot of the expenditures will simply come back to you in extra revenues as a result of the increased output and employment. Not all of it. I completely agree with you, Laura. There is going to be a longer term problem. In which case, when the economy is strongly recovering, it may well be that you have to raise taxes, and in order to start balancing your budget. Keynes didn't believe that you always had to run unbalanced budgets. He thought normally you run balanced budgets. And it's just that when you're in a situation where your revenues are collapsing, then it's right to spend. But when your revenues are buoyant or becoming buoyant, you do balance the budget. So he's not someone who says just spend, and to hell with inflation. Of course not. And neither am I.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about economic crisis and the return, big time, of John Maynard Keynes. Keynesian economics. Robert Skidelsky, Lord Robert Skidelsky, joins us from London. He is the great biographer of Keynes. John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, economist, philosopher, statesman. His epic, three volumes rolled into one. Let's take a call from Saranac Lake, New York. David, you're on the air with Robert Skidelsky.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be on the air again, and I hope everything is well with you. I have a suggestion for what we might want to call potentially the Obama administration. What about the Renewed Deal? And I think that might be the compressing of both of those concepts. In our own area of North Country in upstate New York, we have a major General Motors plant closing. And the General Motors plant has been in operation since the inauguration of the St. Lawrence Seaway. Wow. I was just wondering what he has to say about the auto bailout.
Robert Skidelsky.
I'm not sure whether it's been finally decided.
It hasn't. I mean, Congress said no. The Senate said no. The White House is indicating it's going to do something. People are expecting some $14 billion or who knows what, and maybe many, many tens of billions beyond.
And President-elect Obama hasn't said yes. Is that right?
He's indicated that he's amenable, but he hasn't laid out a plan.
Well, I do think they do require some short-term help. Of course, I do think they do. I think there's a long-term problem, which is that the auto manufacturers have been complacent. They're not very competitive, and the danger with bailouts, as with all bailouts, is that you simply encourage people to go on behaving in the same inefficient way as they did before, and you transfer the risk of that behavior to the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is always a danger in doing these things, but I think at the moment you've just got to try and get the economy going again. And the best way to get automobile workers in work is manufacturing cars. And they've got to be helped to do that for the time being. But the long term prospect is very different. You see, a lot of the American economy is actually quite uncompetitive, and jobs have been offshored to China for years now. And there's been a kind of bargain, really. That's actually what the basis of globalization is, that the Americans get cheap goods made in China, and they get Chinese savings to get into debt with.
Mm.
And that whole system has got to unravel. But it's got to be liquidated, that imbalance. But for the moment, first things first. That's what Keynes would have said. First things first. Get the economy moving again. Then we talk about all these other things.
Let's go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm calling to ask about the explicit downside risks to the bond markets and the dollar for a large stimulus package right now. This wouldn't simply be large Keynesian stimulus. We've already had $8 trillion of bailouts, and when you compare the size of those bailouts to things you've been discussing, the Vietnam War, the New Deal, the Louisiana Purchase, and real inflation-adjusted dollars, I mean, these things are all these huge previous programs, which are very important, are just tiny slivers compared to the huge bailouts we've already had. So, how good is this new debt looking forward? That's something I'm concerned about.
Well, I don't think the bailouts have been anything like that much so far. There have been guarantees and pledges.
$700 billion put up, and more than that in stimulus. Yeah, half of that put out.
$7 trillion.
No.
But of course, they have been large, and there will be effects. I don't think myself that it will have force up the price of U.S. government debt too much. You know, the American economy is still the strongest and largest in the world. The American government is very creditworthy. There are maybe now some Europeans are a bit more creditworthy, but that won't last long either. We're all in this mess together, and if you look at individual countries, the United States is still the one where people would prefer to put their money, and you can see that to some extent, despite the huge current account imbalances that have grown up in the last few years, in spite of the growing U.S. federal deficit, the dollar has not collapsed, and I don't think it will either.
I mean, with the Fed rate at near zero now, it's down to a 13-year low against the Japanese yen yesterday.
I know. You think there'd be a sort of complete flight away from returns as low as that, but there won't be, because if you're looking for a hole, America is as safe as most holes.
That's
not going to change. That's not going to change in a hurry. I really don't think the downside risk of the U.S. government running out of credit and not being able to sell its bonds is that as serious as has just been suggested.
Let's go to Afton, Virginia, and Ned. Hi, Ned. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What a great program. I'm a very enthusiastic supporter of Keynesian economics, and I do think we need to throw everything and the kitchen sink at this problem. My concern is that the average person will not understand the significance of the numbers. As a matter of fact, there are many programs that use a lot of numbers in the trillions and billions, and they are kind of put off by that. And I just like to mention that $1 trillion is only $3,300 per person in the U.S.
It doesn't sound like nothing. I mean,
$3 trillion is $10,000. So, what I'm saying is, for example, when they mentioned the U.K.'s approach to this, the bailout, I heard the number, but I don't know the population. So I think just in general, it would be wonderful if we could all just discuss it in terms of per capita costs, so that we realize that this is not the end of the world, and 20 times what we make in a year.
Robert Skidelsky, I imagine you would agree that it's within the realm of reasonable given the challenge.
Absolutely. You know, we can exaggerate enormously. For example, the ratio of debt to GDP in the UK is 40. It's 40%. Now, after the Second World War, it was about 200%. In wars, governments run up much more debt than they're doing at this time, and they don't run out of credit either. Now, you might say everyone is patriotic in a war and wants to lend the government money, and that they're not prepared to do that lend nearly as much to fight a depression. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that, but they're not going to be asked to lend nearly as much. And so I think I agree completely with what the last caller, phone-in person mm-hmm. said, that we've got to keep a control over the figures we use. And the trouble is that trillions now sound enormous, but that's because we're all very much richer than we were, and people in earlier times were using much lower figures than they are now. Yeah. But we still haven't made the mental adjustment to the fact that very, very much higher nominal figures don't represent very much higher real figures.
Still sounds like a lot to me. Let's go to Jamil.
Yeah, it is a lot.
Jamil.
Yes,
please.
I mean, have we got another questioner or another phone in? Because I wanted to take you up on something you said, Tom, about the possibility of a hybrid.
Oh, yes. May I get one more caller, and then I want to go to that. I think that's maybe most important. Let's get Jamil in Medford, Massachusetts. Jamil, you're on the air with Lord Robert Skidelsky.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you.
One point I wanted to bring up that I don't hear anybody talking about is the individual's personal responsibility in this. No, I firmly believe that if we would make, now this is a big project, but make everybody in this country take a financial education course, learn how to budget their money, learn how to make a list of their bills, learn how to stay organized so their bills get paid, learn how checking accounts work.
From the ground up.
From the ground up, and then give them a stimulus check. Like, you don't get a stimulus check unless you go online and take this course. I guarantee you, I teach financial education. I teach to teens, and I also teach adults. There are so many adults out there with jobs that get money and have no idea how to get their bills paid on time.
What about congressmen and women? Would you sign them up?
Absolutely. The richer, the more important. Trust fund kids have no idea how a checking account works. There's adults. I have a client who's a surgeon, and he has no idea how to get his bills paid on time. He didn't know the difference between a checking account and a savings account when he went to the bank.
Jamil, you're great, but our clock is clicking down. Robert Skidelsky, how about it? The sort of whole culture around getting things straight, balancing things. I don't know if Ken's worried about that or not, but maybe.
Yeah, well, he did. And, of course, no one could be against what you just said about financial education. But I'm afraid that financial instruments have become so complicated. They're very, very ingenious. I mean, the high-powered maths has been used to create these intermediary and derivative instruments. So that not even trained accountants, you know, the audit committees in all the companies that have got into trouble were stuffed with financial experts. I mean, they didn't understand what the heck was going on. And although I think it would have helped enormously at the lower level, and particularly in thinking about how much mortgage you could afford to take out and so on. Of course, I'm in favor of it. But that's not going to solve the problem, because the world has become so complicated and the financial engineering so opaque and non-transparent that even a good quality financial education wouldn't allow you to penetrate into its heart.
Once you get way up beyond that checkbook and into all the derivatives and everything else. All right, let's go to this hybrid question. You mentioned this golden age, mid-20th century, and as I recall, growth, GDP growth in that time was 3% plus in the U.S. Then, of course, we had the market years, the Reagan years, Milton Friedman. I think it was about 3% plus in those as well. But now we're in tatters. We're in trouble here. Before, though, we ended up in inflation in the 70s. Do we just swing back to Keynes? Do we swing to something new? Is there a hybrid out there?
Well, you know, the whole of the history of economic life and also many other aspects of life has been dominated by these swings. You know, it's like a pendulum that, and each when it swings outwards to one extreme, there's a crisis, and the crises are rather different crises. I think the crisis of Keynesian economics, or big government, if you like, was a crisis of power, and now we're in the other type of economy. We've got a crisis of money. Both produce their own kinds of corruption. But it doesn't just swing mechanically from one extreme to another, because there's always a momentum behind one, which isn't completely destroyed when you have a swing back. So I think you will swing back to a hybrid. I don't think Milton Friedman is going to be chucked out of the window as Keynes was. In fact, Keynes wasn't ever completely chucked out. There was some bit of Keynes in economics, even in the last 20 25 years. I think the deficiency of the last 25 years of free markets was volatility. It's not that they didn't produce a rate of growth that was all right. It wasn't much different from the Keynesian rate of growth. But the markets were much more volatile. We've had about 10 or 12 major financial crises in the last 15 or 20 years, most of them offshore as far as the United States was concerned. And so we haven't noticed them so much. And this is the accumulation of them all. And that's what we've got to try and avoid in the future.
I want to ask you about something else. You gave a speech just a week ago or so in the House of Lords, the Queen's speech there. You gave it, and at one point you said, we have to consider whether as a society we want to tolerate the extreme inequalities of wealth and income that have built up over the last 20 years, especially at the very top. And then you said, the emergence of an insolent, largely footloose financial aristocracy, or I should say plutocracy, is the direct result of the dominance of the financial services sector in our economy, the freeing of capital movements from national control, reversal of previously equalizing tax policies in the Reagan and Thatcher years. A big crisis gives us the opportunity to consider that. How important is that? How big a deal?
I think in the long term it's very important. I don't think the capitalist system can survive if there isn't some relationship which most people can accept between reward and effort. The people in the financial services industries, and considering especially that they haven't lifted the growth rate of the economy from what it was before they became so dominant, their rewards are out of all proportion to the value they contribute. I think that's got to be addressed. Now, it was addressed in the past. It was addressed by more redistributionary tax policies. It's what happened to the post-tax incomes that has really spread the inequality. And I think you've got to equalize post-tax incomes a bit more. Now, there I say hybrid. I'm not suggesting that you go back to rates of taxation that, say, we had in Britain for most of the post-war years, when the top marginal rate was 80% or 90%, and you had huge capital taxes and all these discouraging taxes. I'm not suggesting we go back all the way to that, but we've got to have some way of compressing the reward structure of an economy. Otherwise, I think you'll get socialism coming back as an alternative, and people say this society is unfair and unjust. Now, I know in the United States it's a terrific land of opportunity, and people are prepared to accept huge disparities in reward because they want to get on, and they can earn them themselves, possibly with a bit of luck, but not too big.
Not too big. A final bit of advice there from Lord Robert Skidelsky, great economist and biographer of Keynes. His three volumes in one, John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, economist, philosopher, statesman. Thank you very much for taking the time in London today. We're very grateful for it, and thank you for joining us.
It was a great pleasure.
Lord Robert Skidelsky. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.